Much of author Russell Banks' new novel, The Reserve, takes place up in the air, on a pontoon biplane, to be exact. The protagonist is a pilot and an artist named Jordan Groves. He flies around the Adirondack Mountains in pursuit of clarity and love. The geography is familiar territory for author Russell Banks. Many of his novels, including The Sweet Hereafter, unfold in the mountains of upstate New York. But the new one, The Reserve, is written more in the style of a noir novel of the 30s. It's the story of a love square, where the protagonists cross the boundaries of marriage and class. My colleague Jackie Lydon spoke with Russell Banks.
Russell Banks, you've set this story at a place called The Reserve in the middle of the Depression. Would you describe this wilderness area and some of the inhabitants in it, please?
Well, it's the largest and maybe the last true wilderness in the northeastern United States. And in the late 19th century, wealthy Manhattanites and New Englanders started migrating up there for the summer and building vast camps. They called them camps, but they were elaborate mansions, many of them. And their relationship with the local people quickly turned into a relationship between a ruling class of grandees, on the one hand, and permanent residents of the poor who lived, for the most part, off these people as servants and guides and housekeepers and cooks and so on.
You based Jordan Groves, your protagonist, on a real-life painter named Rockwell Kent. Tell us more about Rockwell Kent.
He's a fascinating figure. He lived most of his life in the same region, and he fascinated me for a number of reasons. One is that he was a radical leftist and identified with and sympathized with the working poor. And yet his clientele and his social milieu, the people with whom he spent most of his time, were from the elite classes.
Groves, like Kent, makes these rough-hewn mm-hmm. woodcuts and mm-hmm. builds fireplaces out of river boulder. A man's man, you'd have to say.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. But an archetypal American artist. In a way, it's a moral fable, I suppose. And I like thinking of Jordan Groves as a kind of type that is a little bit lost to memory, maybe.
There's so much lushness in this, and yet there's a lot of tautness, too, because we're very riveted as to where the story's going, and we're very divided. Everybody knows their place here, and yet they dare to step outside it, whether it's they're poor and they are stepping into the world of wealth, whether they are married and they're stepping outside the bounds of marriage. Affairs, which are acted upon and imagined, run throughout this novel. And one of the themes you explore is the difference between secrets and lies. And there's a moment when Vanessa Cole says this marvelous passage. She's a young divorcee, and she says, "Secrets aren't like lies. They're more like brain surgery. They kill your soul. Lying is only a technique for keeping secrets."
Yeah, I'm very interested in this novel, particularly, I guess, in the difference between secrets and lies and truth-telling, and perhaps also the impossibility of knowing another human being truly.
Do you think that this novel is more romantic, more unabashedly romantic than others that you've written?
Oh, certainly. That and also there's a distance in the narrative. I mean, I wanted to try to tell the story from the air, both literally and figuratively. And then the narrative is a third-person omniscient narrative, which I'm not usually associated with. Usually I rely on a first-person narrator. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I wanted that distance to deal with characters who are very complicated and double-sided and who don't really know themselves deeply or well, but appear to know themselves well.
At some point, Jordan Groves' wife, Alicia, who is Austrian-born, says to him, "You envy the poor." And the book concludes with the perspective of a man who lives by his hands. And I want to now ask about this book in contrast to others you've written. So many are about plain lives of working class mm-hmm. people. Is that true of you? Do you envy the poor, Russell Banks?
Well, I think she goes on and realizes that what he really envies is what he sees as their innocence. I don't personally feel that I envy the poor. Having been poor and having been raised poor, I certainly don't. And I don't think that I share with Jordan a view that the poor are innocent necessarily. I'm not even sure I believe in innocence. But I understand how a person who was raised in poverty or in deprivation of one type or another, having removed himself from that, can look back and have a certain kind of almost nostalgia for it. And it goes with guilt. There's a kind of class guilt, I think, that I do feel and I can admit to. And one way of expressing that guilt is to the first and perhaps the most awkward and maybe illegitimate way is through envy.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you about your new novel, The Reserve. Thank you so much, Russell Banks, for joining us.
Well, thank you, too, Jack.
You can read an excerpt about the night a mysterious plane landed at The Reserve at npr.org/books.
Put a bottle of gin there, he'll get in there, my old man. My old man. My old man.
Move over Harry Potter, step aside Bridge to Terabithia. There's a new set of titles dominating the bestseller list for kids' chapter books, and there is nothing fantasy about these. It's the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, written and drawn by Jeff Kinney. These are the journals of Greg Heffley, detailing his trials as a scrawny kid, making the life-changing transition from elementary to middle school.
I like the humor in it. It's very, very funny.
Jonah Aronson is a big Wimpy Kid fan. He's a student with Mrs. Rushfield's third grade class at the Charles E. Smith Jewish Day School in Rockville, Maryland. Here, Jonah reads from the latest book, Roderick Rules, about Greg and his bully of a brother, Roderick, getting punished after a pushing match. Jonah also describes one of the book's illustrations to his classmates.
Mom told me that Roderick and I each had to write down what we did wrong, and then we had to draw a picture to go along with it. Well, Mom's idea might have worked great on a bunch of four-year-olds, but she's going to have to think of something better if she wants me and Roderick to get along. And chose Greg's drawing, and it says, I will not call Roderick names. And then it shows Greg calling Roderick, who in this picture is a baby. He's literally a baby, a bunny rabbit. And Roderick going, wah! And then in the next picture, Roderick shows, I will not push Gregory. And so it shows Roderick pushing Gregory into this ocean with a shark in it. And he's saying, hey! Or something like that.
If the kids' enthusiasm doesn't speak for itself, listen to this. The first book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 40 weeks. The second, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Roderick Rules, debuted this week at number one. Author Jeff Kinney joins me now. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure. Let's describe these books for our listeners. They don't look like normal kids' chapter books. They're like copies of the main character's diary.
Right. I actually got the idea from being a failed cartoonist, actually. I really wanted to be a newspaper strip cartoonist, and I found myself playing far too many video games. So I started keeping a journal to kind of shame myself into writing my comic strips. But as I was writing a journal, I was doing these little doodles in the margins, and I thought, that's a pretty appealing format.
The story is told from the point of view of Greg Heffley. He's the main character. He's the wimpy kid. This is his diary. Describe Greg for us.
I actually think Greg is a bit morally bankrupt. I think he's he's petty. He's a little bit wicked. He's put upon, but he also treats the people underneath him a little bit badly. But I think that Greg's just kind of an average kid.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of an example of how he is not the best kid and not the worst kid.
Well, I'm thinking about the one story where Greg, he does something wrong at school and he's going to get in trouble for it, or he can let his friend take the fall. And Greg's mother the night before kind of senses that something's wrong. She doesn't pry. She just tells Greg that he should do the right thing because he needs to live with the consequences of his actions. And so Greg ultimately decides that the right thing at least the right thing for himself, is to let his friend take the fall. And so then when Greg gets home, you know, from school that day, the mother asks, did you do the right thing? And Greg says, yeah. And she takes him out for ice cream. And I think in Greg's universe and Greg's morality, he really did do the right thing. And what I like about the book is that by doing it as a diary or a journal, there's no adult around to correct Greg.
Do you think that's why kids identify with Greg?
I think so, and I hope so. I hope that kids can recognize that Greg doesn't do the right thing. That's something that I worried about when releasing this to a kid audience, because I actually wrote it for adults. I was trying to write a book that was nostalgic, like The Wonder Years or A Christmas Story, and instead it's going right to the kids, which is really interesting for me.
I wonder what you think adults could get from this. Why were you writing this for adults?
I thought that the irony in the book was more suited for a more sophisticated sense of humor. But maybe in a way I wasn't really giving kids enough credit for what they can understand.
Hmm. It's really an important time for kids, the kids that read your books, not the adults, the transformation from elementary school to middle school. And Greg is struggling with how not to be a kid anymore, doesn't right. want to be elementary school. He wants to be cool, like middle school. He's in a lot of turmoil.
Yes, he is. It's true. I think that seventh and eighth grade, it really is the toughest time for a kid because you haven't quite grown into your body yet. And where I grew up, they had junior high, which was like seventh and eighth grade together.
That's what I went to, yeah.
And I always thought of it as they were segregating you from the general population. Like, what do we do with these people? We'll just put them over here. And you really did have some kids who are twice the size of other kids, like literally twice the size. And so I just thought that that was a great setting. And I think if we as adults were put back into our seventh and eighth grade bodies and put in those situations that we wouldn't act with any more maturity, you know, we would all revert to the behaviors that we had at that age.
Certainly seems like there is a hunger for this stuff, at least among the third graders that our producer here talked to. Mm-hmm. And the big question that they yeah. have for you, Jeff Kinney, is can we get more?
Yes, absolutely.
What's next for Greg Heffley, your character?
Well, the third book is going to be about a conflict that Greg has with his father that puts him into mortal peril. He's going to get shipped off to military academy unless he changes his ways. And even you can understand the awfulness of that, I think.
The terror. Right? The terror.
And then the fourth book will be about Greg's summer. And then the fifth book is Undetermined.
Ah, but at least three more to come at this point.
At least three more to come. Absolutely.
Jeff Kinney is the author of Diary of a Wimpy Kid. The second book in the series just came out. It's subtitled Roderick Rules. And both titles now sit atop the New York Times bestseller list for children's chapter books. Jeff Kinney, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And special thanks to Mrs. Rushfield and her third grade class. You can read an excerpt about the wimpy kid's battles with his brother and see a few of Greg's drawings at npr.org/books.
Our series, You Must Read This, features authors talking about the books they love. Today, we're going to hear from Michael Chabon. He wrote The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, among other things. He recommends a lesser-known book by the man who created Sherlock Holmes.
By 1893, as you might know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was heartily sick of Sherlock Holmes. So he arranged to have his great creation tangle with a murderous arch-villain named Professor James Moriarty beside a high waterfall on a convenient Swiss Alp. You may also know that 10 years later, Conan Doyle was obliged by financial pressures to reveal to a grateful world that Holmes had merely staged his own death. But did you know that in between gleefully killing off and somewhat reluctantly reviving him, Arthur Conan Doyle created another great fictional character, one who easily rivals Holmes, if not for intelligence, then for heroism, bravery, and dash? A character who exceeds Holmes in the one trait in which the great detective, by his own admission, was always deficient, a rich and lovable humanity. This hero A handsome, charming, and resourceful cavalry officer serving in the Grand Army of Napoleon has only one tragic flaw, though in his own eyes, of course, it is his glory and his single greatest advantage in life. He is a Frenchman. His name is Brigadier Étienne Gérard, and he starred in 17 short stories that Conan Doyle wrote with a palpable sense of liberation after pushing Holmes off that alpine ledge. In their day, they were almost as popular as the Holmes stories, but I have to confess that even though I'm a lifelong Sherlockian, I'd never heard of The Good Brigadier. In its pages, you will find adventure, action, romance, love and self-sacrifice, hairsbreadth escape and reckless courage, gallantry, panache, and a droll backhand humor that rivals P.G. Wodehouse. Étienne Gérard, like all Frenchmen ever conceived of by Englishmen, is vain, conceited, self-important, and blind to anything that does not touch directly on his honor. He is also tender, affectionate, and sensitive. Conan Doyle placed himself imaginatively into the heart, soul, and boots of a French cavalry officer, a man sworn to fight and kill Englishmen. With humor, affection, and real insight into a soldier's life, Conan Doyle bridges the gap between him and his dashing popinjay of a hero. His artistry bridges the gap between our century and his, between a world lit by torches and whale oil lamps and our own, between a time when war was still conducted face to face and our dehumanized era of collateral damage and target-rich environments. That act of imaginative sympathy is the requirement and blessing of literature, and it calls forth a similar act in the mind of the reader. It's one that few writers have ever pulled off more touchingly and winningly than in these unjustly forgotten tales by a great master.
Michael Chabon is the author of The Yiddish Policeman's Union and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Robert Krulwich points out that blind people aren't the only ones who have hallucinations. Deaf people hallucinate sounds that aren't there. Amputees hallucinate limbs that aren't there. Brains make stuff up. In fact, Herman Melville, in his novel Moby Dick, tells a hallucination story. His sea captain, Ahab, is missing a leg because a whale ate it. And at chapter 108 in the book, and you can look this up, he says to a friend, "I know my leg is missing, and yet for some reason it feels like it's still there, still part of me." "You can feel your leg, right?" he tells his friend. "It feels attached." Then he says, and I'm quoting here, "Where thou feelest tingling life, there, exactly there, there to a hair do I." Isn't it a riddle? A riddle indeed. Captain Ahab's brain was behaving just like David Stewart's brain, compensating for a loss.
Support for the story on Charles-Bonnet syndrome was provided by the Dana Alliance for Brain Initiatives at dana.org.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. For more than 70 years, Scarlett O'Hara has been an icon of female charm and determination.
As God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again.
A Southern belle and daughter of the Confederacy, the heroine of Gone with the Wind has been revered and reviled through the decades. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates is a Scarlett fan, which surprises a lot of people because Karen is black. For today's installment of In Character, our series exploring famous fictional characters, she examines Scarlett O'Hara and her controversial legacy, especially among black women.
I first read Gone with the Wind in the summer of 1966. At the time, several American cities were erupting into flames as black communities protested decades of police brutality, and the Vietnam War was becoming a national obsession. Me? I was a 15-year-old in New Haven, Connecticut. My parents were still referring to themselves as Negroes, but I was already calling myself Black. Despite that, I was also immersed in the mid-19th century South, where another teen was railing against the preoccupation of her day.
War, war, war. This war talk's spoiling all the fun at every party this spring. I get so bored I could scream.
Scarlett O'Hara was the founding mother of the Me Generation, and frankly, my dear, I found her unabashed self-interest delicious. My mother, on the other hand, was mystified. Why would her child, who would eventually sport a 2-foot-wide afro, be so interested in a plantation belle? She couldn't know it, but I wasn't the only Black girl who was mesmerized by Scarlett. 1,000 miles away, writer Pearl Clegg was growing up in a Detroit household that was Afrocentric before Afrocentric became popular. Her mother, like mine, didn't get the Scarlett attraction either.
The idea that I could be reading this book about the lives of slave owners just drove my mother crazy. And she, you know, really kind of said to me, if you're going to read this book, you need to be identifying with Prissy and with Mammy, not with Miss Scarlett, which, of course, was not possible. No 11-year-old girl on the west side of Detroit wants to identify with people who are owned by a little white girl.
People like Prissy and Mammy devoted house slaves to Scarlett's family.
Mammy, here's Miss Scarlett's victuals.
You can take that all back. And I won't need to buy it.
Pearl Clegg loved that Scarlett insisted on living life on her own terms.
She had such a strong self-definition that she didn't really care what other people thought.
Oh, now, Miss Scarlett, you come on and be good and eat just a little.
No, honey. I'm going to have a good time today and do my eating at the barbecue.
If you don't care what folks says about this family, I does. I has told you and told you that you can always tell a lady by the way that she eats in front of folks like a bird. And
the girl kept slaves, for God's sake. So what was it about this story and this woman that Pearl and I found so alluring? I think we both liked that Scarlett was feisty and stubborn. She allowed herself to be what every nice girl from her day to ours was told not to be, selfish. Like here, when she and Rip Butler have just married and he tells her he'll spend as much as she wants on the new mansion she's planning in Atlanta.
Oh, Red, won't everyone be jealous? I want everybody who's been mean to me to be pea green with envy.
What a brat. But you've got to love her insistence on payback, kind of like flipping off the mean girls table in the school lunchroom. The bravery of the heroine Margaret Mitchell, originally named Pansy O'Hara, her publisher asked her to change the name, was enticing to many girls in the pre-feminist 60s. Back then, we were still expected to defer to boys, to look nice and stay sweet. Scarlett wasn't having it. Remember, this is a girl who killed a Yankee.
Well, I guess I've done murder. I won't think about that now. I'll think about that tomorrow.
But while she might symbolize resilience for some, for others, especially for Southern women who are Black, Scarlett is something else altogether. Novelist and Georgia native Tina McElroy Ansa says the Scarlett everyone else admires leaves her cold because her character is rooted in an assumption of racial superiority.
There is a possibility that people just take the best parts from her character to identify with. But for me, it's very difficult to take some things and let the rest rot, because it was so clearly that her higher place in society meant my place had to be lower.
Protecting the sanctity of white womanhood led in part to the birth of the Ku Klux Klan. Ansa believes there's a lot of unspoken stuff to work through before honest discussions about race can occur.
And I think, the Scarlett O'Hara iconic figure sort of stands in the way of that.
I think she's right. I'm very clear that the specter of who owned whom and its nasty after effects will be with us for a long, long time in this country. My adult self still likes Scarlett, but I understand Missy is part of a painful, complicated history we're still trying to work out. Even so, some parts of Scarlett transcend race. It might be a stretch for some people, but Pearl Clegg says civil rights icon Fannie Lou Hamer, a Black Mississippi sharecropper who insisted on her right to vote, is also an inheritor of Scarlett's ambition.
Fannie Lou Hamer is as much a quintessential Southern woman as Scarlett O'Hara, because they both stepped forward and said, no, I'm not going to do what you think I'm supposed to do. I'm free. Because that's the thing I still think about Scarlett that we like, is that she was always determined to be free.
Margaret Mitchell once said Gone with the Wind's overriding theme could be boiled down to survival. Well, lover or loather, Scarlett O'Hara is a survivor. She has that ability to struggle through trauma to reach tomorrow, which, of course, is another day. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
Our In Character series continues online today, where Karen will be blogging about Scarlett O'Hara. And you can also find clips from the movie Gone with the Wind and the parodies that it inspired. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Sergei Tretyakov was an operative of the KGB, the old Soviet intelligence service. When the Soviet Union dissolved, the agency changed its name, but its mission remained the same. Tretyakov was nominally a press officer at the Russian mission to the United Nations. In reality, he was running a number of intelligence agents who in turn were trying to get information out of Americans and others at the UN. He defected in 2000, and 4 years later, with both FBI and CIA agents present, he met with Pete Early, the author of books about several Americans who had spied for Russia. And the result of their meeting is Early's book, Comrade J. It's the story of Tretyakov's career, and both Pete Early and Sergei Tretyakov are here to talk about that story. Welcome.
Thank you.
To both
Thank
of you.
You.
First, Sergei Tretyakov, why did you want to have a book telling your story?
I think that this book can be kind of wake-up call for the Americans. Americans are a little bit naive when they say Cold War is over and right now we can relax. It's not the case for the intelligence. In Soviet military doctrine, there was a definition of potential main enemy. It was United States, NATO, and China. In today's intelligence doctrine, there is definition of main targets: United States, NATO, and China.
Same three.
Same three.
And you're a colonel.
One of the youngest colonel in the Russian system.
When you were the deputy resident, or we would say deputy station chief in New York.
It's the same.
And you defected to the U.S., that was the highest level defection by a Russian intelligence officer, actually in the United States at that time.
Yes, I was deputy resident in New York. It's second largest Russian residency in the world, first in Washington, second in New York.
Pete Early.
Well, New York is important. Look, in Washington, they had walk-ins. They had Walker, they had Ames, people who walked in and volunteered. But recruitment really happens in New York. Why? Because you have the United Nations, and it's a fertile ground of people who won't betray their own country but are easily prone to giving up the United States.
Sergei Tretyakov, I'd like you to tell the story of the source of yours, originally from Ottawa and later New York, named Arthur. What kind of relationship did you have with the man codenamed Arthur?
People like Arthur and many others, they were trusted contacts. I personally don't like very much the word spy. I can tell you that when I work in Canada, we are not that interested in Canadian issues. The main target is the United States.
That Canada can be a window onto the U.S., and you might find Canadians who don't think that much of Washington. They'd be best here.
Exactly. People who don't like America that much.
Pete Early.
Well, with Arthur, like so many of the people that Sergei was able to recruit, they didn't see themselves as deceiving their country. They were targeting the United States. They didn't like the United States. And in Arthur's case, as we say in the book, he went on to Vienna and the UN to be an arms verification expert. And that, of course, puts him in an extremely valuable position for the Russian intelligence.
And Sergei Tretyakov, when you started spying for the United States, I know spying is a word you don't like, but when you were, in fact, the number two Russian intelligence agent or operative in New York, and you'd started working for the U.S., was that the biggest gem that you passed to U.S. Authorities?
I don't discuss if I worked for the American government or for how long. One of the reasons I don't want my former colleagues to have this food from me. My defection was the major failure of the Russian intelligence, probably in the old history. And no one approached me. No one bought me. It was my decision. It was our family decision. Because finally I understood that I must do something good in my life.
It was a decision motivated in part by what you made of the changes in Russia, in the changes during the Yeltsin and later the Putin era.
Starting from Gorbachev. When Gorbachev came into power, we became optimistic. Then Yeltsin came. we became optimistic. And Yeltsin happened to be just a professional alcoholic. Putin came. Some people were optimistic. I don't see any reasons for optimism. I call this process a genocide of Russian people. And if I returned back to Russia, I was supposed to be among this 2-3% people who are eating beluga caviar and drinking champagne. And I thought that it's immoral. I didn't want to be the part of the genocidal team.
But you estimated at the moment of your defection that your estate, and you've been a career KGB, SVR person all this time, that your estate amounted to about or in excess of $2 million at that point. How did you accumulate that much property, being an intelligence
family
agent? Inherited wealth.
Inherited, yes. It's we inherited a lot of property. And we lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
We lost it. And what?
you write in the book, and it's been said that you were given the best compensation package by the U.S. government for coming here. Not why you did it. I know you're not saying that. But was that in part because of what you were giving up?
I don't discuss my package. Please don't count my money.
Okay.
I was told by the FBI that he had the highest settlement package, over $2 million, and that he brought us more than 5,000 top secret cables, and he exposed all the operations in New York, including who the Russian contacts were. And in one of the stories in the book shows, help can understand why he feels the way he did, was he got this Alexander Kramer in the Food for Oil program, who was one of his deep cover officers. And that guy helped Russia steal $500 million.
Let me ask both of you one last question, because Pete Early, you've written books about Aldrich Ames, the Russian mole and the CIA. You also wrote about the Walker family, who were spies within the Navy. First, Sergei Tretyakov, do you find anything in common with those people?
First of all, as far as I know, they worked for money. They were bought. No one bought me. It was my ideology.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the main interest. I was fighting the system back. I was never worked against my colleagues. And actually, none of my colleagues suffered in any way. And I consider myself American patriot, not American catch.
Well, so the difference being the others, the Walkers or Ames, you see as mercenaries in what they were doing. What do you think, Pete Early?
One difference with Sergei is not only did he give us their secrets, he risked his life by working for him, but then he came here and became a U.S. citizen by choice. He didn't flee to another country. And Walker and Ames never wanted to go to the Soviet Union.
Pete Early and Sergei Tretyakov, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pete Early's book is Comrade J, and you can read more about why Sergei Tretyakov defected and why he decided to tell his story in an excerpt of the book that's at npr.org.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.